News Centre at 6. A cruise ship passenger in Japan has become the first British person to die from coronavirus. He's the sixth victim of the outbreak on the Diamond Princess. Three more cases have been confirmed in the UK, two in England and one in Wales. After being criticised for a lack of leadership on the issue, Boris Johnson says COVID-19 is now the government's top priority, and he's issued this advice.
Wash our hands for 20 seconds or more. With hot water and soap. And that's the best single piece of advice we can give.
Meanwhile, the president of football's world governing body has hinted next month's international friendlies might have to be scrapped because of the virus. Among the games in March, England have Wembley contests with Italy and Denmark. The foreign secretary has condemned the killing of at least 33 Turkish soldiers in Syria yesterday. NATO's urging Syria and Russia to stop their airstrikes, which are causing people to flee towards Greece. A man has died after being chased and attacked by a man with an axe in Partington in Greater Manchester. A 31-year-old has been arrested on suspicion of murder. Greta Thunberg's warned global leaders she won't be silenced while the world is on fire. Speaking at a march in Bristol, the 17-year-old said politicians were acting like children and ignoring the looming climate disaster. Tens of thousands of students skipped school to go, including Daisy.
The atmosphere was incredible. Everyone was having so much fun. It was amazing to be around so many like-minded young people who are so passionate about climate change. And to listen to Greta speak was also so inspiring.
Some parts of Wales and northern England are being warned of more heavy rain as Storm Jorge hits Britain. Strong winds are forecast for much of the UK tomorrow, reaching 70 miles per hour in coastal areas. Flooding along parts of the River Severn's expected. That's the latest. I'm Elizabeth Secker.
Love Bristol. Love BCFM 93.2.
What's that lovely noise I hear you say? Yes, it's the noise of politics on BCFM 93.2, broadcasting live across Bristol and worldwide on bcfmradio.com. If you're thinking, Tony Gosling sounds very Irish this evening, incorrect. My name is Billy Quain, depping in for him for the next 2 weeks. Busy show this week. Greta Thunberg, Time Magazine's Person of the Year and twice nominated for a Nobel Prize, was in town today. We're going to be chatting planning, politics, policies and all things Labour with Trooper Hill and St. George's Trooper Hill Ward Councillor Fabian Brickles. Dr. David Jewell is popping in to discuss all things coronavirus. Oh my God! Martin Summers is in the studio. We're going to be picking over the carcass of the rest of this week's news. And my, there is a lot of it. Top of the evening, chaps. I'm going to fade down the theme music now. I think we've got quite a lot to be getting our chops around. Fabian, good evening to you. How do you do?
Not too bad. How are you?
I'm well, thank you for asking. First time we've met. I'm delighted to make your acquaintance. Martin Summers, how has the week been?
Well, I've just been working, and here I am on Friday, as I often am, to join in the politics show.
Indeed, putting the world to rights. Okay, so we will start off by introducing Labour Councillor for St. George's, Troopers Hill, Fabian Brickles, to the listeners. How are you?
Yeah, not bad. I'm actually Labour and Co-op councillor because some of us are also members of the Cooperative Party, and that's a sister party, and we have an arrangement where we stand joint councillor, joint candidates.
Excellent. And does the Cooperative Party predate the Labour Party?
I think it does. It's certainly been around for a while.
I merely ask because it is an election campaign for the National Labour Party, and divisions, or should I say inconsistencies, or non-conformity across the party membership are becoming more apparent as the election gathers momentum. Let's talk a little bit about you, first of all, and what brought you to politics?
What brought me to politics was I wasn't happy. I joined the party in 92, and I wasn't, mainly because I wasn't happy with how the country was being run. I didn't like the inequality. I didn't like the country being ill at ease with itself. I felt we could be better, we deserve to be better, and I wanted to get into politics to change things for the better for people. And a lot of my work is actually the casework, which is actually about the practical bread and butter issues that affect people's daily lives. And actually, to be honest with you, that's the most satisfying bit of it.
I can imagine. And what better way to do that than by running for local elected representative? Mm-hmm. When did you first become a councillor?
Well, I've been in St George since 2007, so consistently. We had a boundary change in 2016 because we got a point where some of the wards had twice the residents of other wards, so there had to be a boundary change. And St George East and West, as was, were divided into three. St George West is a single member ward, St George Troopers Hill is a single member ward, and St George Central as a two person ward, although the actual boundary of St George East and West, the actual outer boundary, stayed the same. So I stood in Troopers Hill in 16 because that's where I'd done most of my casework and most of my successes. So I stood there because I had them.
Excellent. And unusually, turnout in Troopers Hill in 2016 was over 44%, nearly 45%, which isn't bad.
Not bad at all.
Of the total population, according to the Bristol City Council website, 5,800, of which 4,000, just short of 4,500 people are eligible to vote. So, yep. You know, pretty good going.
Yep.
Was this due to the rigour of your campaigning and getting people out and getting people registered?
Well, obviously, we are in the time where time is going to run out if people want to be registered. Wherever you live, wherever you live in Bristol, if you've got with local elections coming up, it's going to be all-out elections. There's going to be the Police and Crime Commissioner. I'm very pleased that Kerry Barker is our Labour candidate again this time. Came very close last time. I really hope he can do it this time. Marvin is defending as Labour's mayor. And, of course, all 70 council seats in Bristol are up as well. Yeah, wherever you live in Bristol, if you haven't registered to vote, you need to register to vote because time will run out.
And whatever your grievance with the council, with the mayor, with the police and crime commissioner, it's no point. I always say rage is a very impotent emotion. Spite, on the other hand, can be harnessed for an awful lot of other things. But the council tax comes out of your account every month. This is your time to hold that money to account.
Yeah.
So do we know when the election is on May the 7th? When is registration closing for the election across Bristol?
I don't actually know the dates off the top of my head.
Okay, let's not worry too much about that. We can get into the thick of that anon. We should talk a little more about your political career. You are a sitting member of the Bristol City Council Planning Committee.
Right, well, there's two committees. There's a DCA and a DCB, so DC means Development Controls. There's A and B. And one of them meets every every 6 weeks, so there's a planning committee meeting every three. It just alternates which one it is. I've been doing that virtually since 2008 or 2009, if not before. So it's something I've done for a fair while. And I was also in the 95 to 90 to 2001, I was working the planning inspector. So I understand some of the process already and some of the, because obviously when we got planning applications, you have to bear in mind what happens if the applicant goes to appeal. And that's just one of the many things you have to think about.
Indeed. Working as a civil servant in the planning office.
Planning inspector.
Planning inspectorate. This wasn't working at Bristol City Council then?
No.
Inspectorate is a national body.
It's a national body. They've got an office in Bristol. They've got an office in Cardiff.
Okay, good. So you will have seen throughout your work in the 90s and early noughties how the harbourside, for instance, around Bristol was redeveloped.
Yeah.
From post-industrial landscape to swanky flats mostly, and not that many other facilities or resources, schools, play areas, this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there were plans for a big Centre for Performing Art that never happened. That space is still sort of empty between the Lloyds building and the end of the, what is now, it's some Rumbo or something like that at the end. So, yeah, there were plans and some have happened. I actually think the area is generally really, really nice, and Wapping Wharf has been a really nice area, you know, and, you know, the sort of eateries down there. It's, you know, it's a really nice place to go, especially on a summer evening.
Indeed. We'll come back to some of the planning issues anon. Are you a Bristol City Council cabinet member?
No, I'm on the back benches.
Okay, because Marvin had a kind of a rainbow cabinet for the first couple of years of his tenure and then decided he liked Labour people better.
Well, I think it was a question of how relations worked. I mean, he was right to give a rainbow cabinet an attempt to work, because the last regime was, there was no overall control in the sort of benches, and it was an independent mayor, so he had to pick from all over to, you know, from people from all over the parties. But, you know, in our case, Marvin gave it a try. It didn't really work. You know, there were issues with some of the games that people may have been playing. So he then felt it was more effective because, you know, he's there to get stuff done. He's not there like me. He's a bit like me in that respect. You're not there to play games or muck about. You're there to get stuff done. So he's finding his, you know, things are moving much better with all Labour cabinet.
Fair enough. And with the mayoral election on May the 7th, would you say you are a Marvinista? Are you pleased that there was no hustings or no potential from within the local Labour Party to field a candidate other than Marvin?
We had the debate and, you know, we had the vote, and overwhelmingly we voted to keep Marvin. And fair enough. So now we need to make sure Bristol hopefully keeps Marvin, because, you know, two of the other parties, you know, the Tories and the Lib Dems, are both vowing to scrap the mayoral position, even though nationally the Conservative government actually wants to roll out more mayors across the country. So they're actually slightly contrary to what National Conservative Party policy is. I think the real reason is that they know they're full well they'll never get a Tory mayor, and the Lib Dems know they'll never get a Lib Dem mayor.
Well, wasn't that the reason they introduced the Metro mayor?
A bit like sort of Avon Council was produced because Labour was a sort of a Bristol was always a splodge of red, so they brought in Avon to sort of try and dilute that a bit, and then when Avon turned red or turned cross party and all of that, they got rid of it again.
Yeah. But, you know, it's like a lot of British negotiations. We're going to be touching on the EU negotiations and Britain's track record in political agreements in the second hour of this evening's broadcast. But British politics does have an aptitude for shifting where the goalposts actually are, most especially after you've kicked the ball.
And we're hampered with a stupid voting system where not all votes count. But I've been in electoral reform. One of the first things I did soon after I joined the Labour Party, I joined the Labour campaign for electoral reform. I've always felt that we ought to be implementing a better voting system that will allow every vote to count. And I think sometimes, you know, you have a system where it's quite negative. One person can come along and split the vote in a marginal seat. That's not fair. You can have people, you know, it's all quite negative. If we had a more proportional system, we could have people voting positively for what they believe in, and I think that would be better for everybody.
Heresy, you speak. Heresy. Anyway, that's your introduction. We're going to pause for a quick bit of music, because we do need to talk about the young people who took to the streets of Bristol earlier today. Here's some Tom Waits.
I'm
There you go. That is Tom Waits. I don't want to grow up, and I sincerely hope Greta Thunberg doesn't grow up too quickly. I'm deeply impressed. Everybody was cynical. Avon and Somerset Police, Inspector Andy Bennett said, yeah, it's going to be a disaster. We haven't got the resources. What the local politicians did today with great elegance was stay out of the way. Fabian Breckles, what are your thoughts on the climate, the student school strike climate protesters in Bristol today?
They have a point. Obviously they have a point, because a lot of, as Greta Thunberg actually said this afternoon, a lot of politicians, we think about the Trumps and the Bolsonaros and Boris Johnson. I mean, the Tories had the worst, I think it was according to Friends of the Earth, they had the worst green credentials of anyone facing at the last election. You know, they've got other priorities. They're not bothered about climate change, and yet we can see the disaster of climate change with the flooding in, flooding in the north of England and just up the road in Gloucestershire. You know, Australia was on fire. We are heading towards catastrophe, and things have to change. And they are right to protest and demand that change happens.
Are we heading towards catastrophe, or are we already there? Because George Monbiot was on Politics Today, Politics Live at lunchtime today. Mm-hmm. He said, "I've been beating my face off this door for 30 years. And in 2 years, Greta has opened this door and the world is listening."
Well, I think the warnings were there for a while and nobody really cared to notice. Obviously we do need to think about how we deal with it, and part of how we deal with it is how we manage climate change. One of the first things I was on when I got elected was there was a floods working group, a cross-party floods working group. There's me, there's a Lib Dem, a Tory, and some officers working, looking at the flood defences in Bristol, what could be done to improve them. If we have adequate flood defence, if we're going to have torrential rain storms in the winter or other times of the year, we need to think about how do we protect homes from flooding and businesses and towns and communities, and also what on earth do we do with this water? We need to think that one through. If we can't stop the torrential rain, we need to think about how we manage it, because places are flooding far more frequently than they used to. Yes, there used to be terrible floods in the past, but they were not as frequent as they were now. The footage of Australia burning with all those uncontrollable forest fires was absolutely terrifying, so we're getting not enough water in some parts of the globe and far too much in others. And how do we manage that? That, needs a global approach.
One of the reasons Greta came to Bristol today is because it was declared a green capital under George Ferguson's mayorship. A climate emergency was declared. Yep. And a whole bunch of other stuff. Bristol Energy Company was set up with George's promise that every single council-owned building, residential and office space, would have solar provision on the roof. There was a large rollout of insulation, which was kind of handed out to a subcontractor.
I think
private
some of that
company
was government funded at the time.
Weird stuff. We're going to talk more about the government funding when we get on to transport as well. And Bristol Waste. And you want, I know, to talk about the transport solutions that Bristol is trying to pioneer. Yeah. And we'll go on to Gen Eco. But, you've been at the coalface with this, as you say, elected to your current position for the first time in 2007. So you've seen this over, 12, 13 years evolving. Are we doing enough? Are we doing enough quickly enough?
I think some of what we could have done has been sort of sabotaged in the past. I remember there was a big plan to have a tram system. It actually got sabotaged by the Lib Dems in South Gloss.
I know.
Because they argued about changing. They wanted to suddenly, right at the very last minute, when it's too late to change the plans, get, you know, alter the plans before government, suddenly decided they wanted to change the terminus and switch it to Cribbs Causeway. Mm-hmm. Now, if they'd said that right at the start, that might have made sense. So, you know, Spite, you know, killed that one off, which is really frustrating. WECO, I know, have the transport brief, and they are funding all this research into whether a rapid underground system would work. That's being funded by WECO. We have recently just got, you know, obviously there's Metrobus, which still needs more bus priority measures, I think. It's going to...
I would love for you to say to my face that it was a massive mistake, because if we look at the brass tacks of it, there was £200 million of government money allocated to it, mm-hmm. which obviously got consumed rapidly. Half of the programme didn't get rolled out. And you now have the Metro, the first bus director general for the South West saying, this system is a complete shambles. It's not working. And when the boss of your closest collaborator on any transport project is saying, this is a shambles, you know that you're maybe climbing up a slippery rope.
I'll tell you why Metrobus wasn't canned when we came in. It was already it was already too far gone. They'd already started work on it before the 2016 elections. And also it was ring-fenced money. Mm. So you either spend it on the Metro, you either spend it on delivering Metrobus, or you hand the money back. And you're just left with whatever unfinished work in the centre, I mean, you know, or anything else that you're left with. You know, if you're left with holes in the ground, you're just left with it. So that's the problem with a lot of government funding. It is so ring-fenced. Mm. It's a question of you spend it on something or you hand it back. We've got a similar problem with the cycle path. I've had somebody contact me about over £1 million that Sustrans is investing in the cycle path, in a part of the cycle path. And he was saying that, well, actually, there's Conham Hill, which is just at the end of my ward, it's actually in South Gloss, is actually quite dangerous for cyclists, and the money would be better spent there. So I did some research, spoke to officers, and, you know, basically, it's the same problem there. The money is ring-fenced, so it goes on that stretch of the cycle path, or it goes back to the Department for Transport. We can't say, hang on, can we just spend this on that over there, because it's more important and more serious?
The Department of Transport, which at the time the Metrobus money was allocated, was run by Chris Grayling. He seemed to stay there for an awfully long time, yeah. despite costing taxpayers £1 million a day over a six-year period for every single day he was in the job. That was his overspend.
Yeah, he had the nickname Failing Grayling. He was a disaster in, was it Justice or somewhere before? I mean, the man was a walking disaster.
Yeah. Anyway, so we inherited that now. You inherited it, you say. What are your thoughts on it? I mean, it is an unmitigated disaster. And the constituent councils are having to make up the shortfall, which so far are at £40 million.
Well, I mean, we've got it. And so what I take the view that as we've got it, we need to try and make it work. A lot of areas where the bus priority isn't there are in South Gloss, because I actually rode a couple of the lines when it first opened. I think it's fixable. It could become the basis for something else in the future. It could be converted to a tram system or something like that in the future. That's possible. Now it's there. It's a start.
Okay.
So it's not necessarily just going to stay as it is forever. And yeah, I was certainly frustrated when I took one of the runs, and as soon as we got out of the M32 and out of that way, we found ourselves stuck in traffic in South Gloss. And I just thought, you know, it's up by the Hamburg roundabout. And I was just thinking, this isn't very impressive.
Well, this is after they had destroyed all of the trees and all of the grade one topsoil that was down at the allotments, which, of course, it was a very easy target to blame the crusties for putting themselves in the trees for the overspend. Mm. That was fractional. There's a perfectly usable Oyster card system that works on Transport for London, but Metrobus decided they needed to have a more unique and idiosyncratic approach to ticketing.
Well, I think the problem is that transport in London is far more regulated. It's much more run much more tightly by the Mayor of London, because he's got powers to regulate transport far more effectively in London than we have. We don't have, and you know, we have a macho mayor who is barely visible, who's now
barely competent, I would say, but you know,
well, he's barely visible, so you don't know what's happening or what he's doing. The whole transport strategy is supposed to be being run from WECA, the West, you know, mm-hmm. the combined authority, because you know, because it makes more sense to have one body coordinating transport over the whole area. Fair enough. But, you know, I'm not convinced he's doing what he can to use his powers. We are looking at a bus partnership, you know, with First. We've got, you know, as a council, we've got a fairly good relationship with First. I was down there a couple of weeks ago. We had the launch of the biogas buses beginning mm-hmm. of February. Very impressive buses. Massive reduction in emissions. Something like 85% reduction in emissions. So huge improvement for air quality, which is a real issue for the whole sort of Lawrence Hill through to St George.
Well, it's an issue for the whole city.
So it's, you know, and, you know, James Freeman is a real, the one thing that came across is he's a real bus enthusiast, which is exactly what you want for someone in that kind of job. So he's looking, you know, he's got the infrastructure in place now at Lawrence Hill. He's looking to roll out, expand the bus, you know, biogas buses across the piece. You think, you know, there's evidence to say that's potentially more efficient. That's more efficient for us than, say, just a purely electric fleet, because of how long batteries last and how you recycle.
Oh, yes, of course.
And so it's actually a very sensible option, and the buses are really nice. But it's teething trouble with the real-time information, which, when it works, is far more sophisticated than it used to be, because it has the current bus, the current stop that's coming up, the next one, and the one after that, so you can plan your journey.
Who's paying for the buses?
They are. First bus, I'm investing a bucket load of dosh.
Who is providing the green energy? Is it a Genico? Is it a Wessex Water tie-up? Is it a Bristol Water tie-up? Where is this stuff coming from? And how much is it being, how much, and who is paying for it?
I think it's coming from I think it's biogas that's going into the national grid. I'm not too sure off the top of my head.
Okay. Presumably, Bristol Waste will have some involvement along the line.
Yeah, the whole point is that the gas they are using is from waste food.
Yeah.
So what they have is a process of accelerating
anaerobic digesters to extract the methane from the food waste, which is
so
then
accelerating what would happen if it was fossilised.
Yeah.
So, and they're basically using waste methane that would go into the air anyway and using it to power buses.
Exactly.
Brilliant.
And then once it is combusted in the engines of these buses, it is appreciably less harmful to the methane from cattle and other livestock going straight into the atmosphere.
And the seats are really nice. Each bus has got two disabled spaces on them. So if a couple of wheelchair users are travelling together, they can travel together now. They couldn't before. And, you know, so, yeah, big improvement.
Excellent. Good. I'm going to be talking more transport next week, because the sainted Tim Kent, Liberal Democrat for
Whitchurch Park.
Yes, Whitchurch Park, an extraordinary man. He will be here in cahoots, I think, with Afzal Shah we've got next week, Labour for Easton.
Afzal's a good bloke. Good,
so it'll be interesting, because we are his local ward here. So that'll be fun. So we'll talk more transport next week. Now, let's talk about the budget, because I'm not a journalist. I had never professed to being. I never actually really want to be. But the rule number one of journalism, certainly investigative journalism, is follow the money. So let's talk about the budget. 4% increase was announced this week, 1.99%, which was discretionary, and a ring-fenced 2% budget for adult and child social care. Am I correct?
Yeah, and, you know, adult social care is a sort of a minefield. It is chronically underfunded by the government. And, you know, I think, you know, it's a no-cuts budget, no new cuts in this budget at all. You know, it's been a real challenge, because we've had 60 pence in every pound withdrawn from government funding, because the way councils are funded is incredibly centralised. In most parts of the world, councils are actually able to raise far more tax of their own, so they're far more self-sufficient. whereas a lot of what we do is dependent on central government funding and grant funding, which is obviously cutting area, you know, more deprived areas and inner cities and shoving all the money in the leafy Tory suburbs. On top of that, we inherited a 30 million black hole, 32 million black hole from the previous regime.
Did the previous regime create that black hole, or did they inherit that from elsewhere?
Well, the Bundred report looked into that, and it looks like they kind of created it, or kind of didn't realise it was happening, or, you know, I mean, most of the senior officers who were around when that happened have gone. Well, they've all gone.
Were they given a Klonowski-style goodbye money?
No, I think they just left.
Okay.
They saw the Bundred report, realised the writing was on the wall and got out.
Okay, good. Well done them. Smart people, the ones who were writing
their own
checks. They
should have made the mess in the first place. They should have got it right.
Well, look, I mean, the problem is when you've got well-intentioned people who are working very hard on half the information they need to do the job effectively, I'm not sure that any decision-making is ever going to be fully accurate.
Yeah, I mean, we always had excellent budget and resources scrutiny work going on during that time. But yeah, half the information that was needed wasn't actually presented.
Try and remove your Labour Party hat, your Labour and Cooperative Party hat for a moment. How much of George Osborne's austerity budgets, which were necessary after Gordon Brown's bank bailouts, which were necessary after Tony Blair's £37 billion going into two illegal wars, and Gordon Brown's subsequent liquidating of Britain's gold reserves. How far back do we chase that turkey?
I think austerity was a political choice. I mean, if we hadn't bailed the banks out, we would have probably had financial collapse. We should have probably done it differently. Maybe brought banks into state ownership rather than bailed them out. That might have been more effective. I don't know what you feel on that, Martin.
I think that's right. I mean, the subprime mortgage collapse in the US was leveraged by the collateralized debt obligation system that evolved. So Britain, in fact, Britain's policy about this, whatever we've done, is not going to be fundamentally changing anything unless we're involved in negotiations with the US, which we are, of course, but we're only minor players. And this stuff, I mean, the same thing happened in Ireland, the same thing happened all over the world.
Yeah, you know, but I mean, the Irish deserved it, and
yeah,
the Icelandics
deserved
it.
But the point is that the underlying all of this is the deregulation of the City of London in the 1980s.
Yep.
And, of course, the City of London is at the heart of the world financial system. So in other words, Britain does have a major responsibility in creating this mess.
And that deregulation was accelerated Blair and Brown.
They did indeed derate that. They bought into the whole thing. The same thing happened with Clinton in the US, where they got rid of the Glass-Steagall Amendment, which stopped retail bankers from getting involved in investment banking. That was all scrapped during a Democrat administration. And that, of course, may open the floodgates to all of this basically jiggery pokery, which should never have been allowed. And it's all very well with hindsight saying they shouldn't have done this. but you get to the situation years later where the mess is still there. There's going to be another crash now. You see what's happening in the stock market this week.
Well, that's a correction.
And also, another issue is that, you know, the biggest lie the Tories managed to spin in the run-up to the 2010 election was that, you know, the crash was just a local thing that only happened in Britain and it was all Labour's fault. It was a global event triggered by the American subprime market.
Yes. No,
I
agree with that.
Actually, at the same time, the Tories were actually wanting more deregulation.
Yeah.
The trickle
not
down,
less.
The trickle-down, however, as you said, is that there is 60% less coming in to Bristol City Hall from central government to spend on the services that the city, the citizens of the city
and the
require.
City, and the city's growing, the demands are growing, we have an ageing population, so social care. A resolution to social care, probably cross-party, needs to be sorted out so the whole thing doesn't just collapse. And obviously with Brexit and sort of the way immigration's being handled, you know, we could end up losing a lot of people that we rely on, European workers rely on, to actually staff social care.
Okay. Do you feel at the moment that Bristol City Council tax represents value for money?
Yes, I do. I think we're doing the best we can with less and less. I mean, you know, we're meeting our pledge to build the housing and the social housing that's needed. There's cranes across the skyline. We are getting stuff done. And, you know, the choice for voters is, do they want to carry on getting stuff done to make Bristol better? Or do they want to go back to the old, you know, do they want to end up with some kind of, you know, nothing happening really much?
I do hear this a lot, especially from Labour politicians in town. Do you, it's this, it's almost, it's not a threat, but it's a reminder of how awful things used to be.
Yeah, I mean, we used to have elections by thirds every year, which meant that no long-term planning happened. And, you know, everyone was thinking about the next round of elections, the next leaflet, which seats were being targeted. And, you know, everything, any decisions and anything, you know, the budget debates and anything like that, all skewed towards that. And that's not the way to do it. At least this four-year all-outs, is, apart from it's much better value for money for the taxpayer because you've got one round of elections, not four. So it's a lot cheaper. But it actually means you've got 4 years where we know who we've got elected, just about. There might be the odd by-election here and there, but largely speaking, you've got an administration elected, you've got the mayor elected, and you get on with it for 4 years and you make it work.
Okay.
And that's far better for everyone.
We're going to pause and take some music. I asked you that question purely because there seems to be a lot of large cheque writing, £12.5 million to prepare the ground at Temple Island. There is now a sort of a pledge which has slightly been redacted, which slightly hasn't, of another £32 million to prepare the land for development by venture capitalists, essentially, Legal & General, who I think are in financial services, not in house building. We'll come to that. There is talk this week. Jeff Gollop is particularly concerned about Bristol Energy potentially requiring another £10 million bailout from the City Council. And this is part of the budget which none of the opposition councillors have had access to the proposals in this so far. If I read my Bristol Live as accurately as I hope I did,
I think everyone had access to the budget, and there was legal advice. Jeff Gollop at the budget meeting last week did make a lot of fuss about some papers that were going to cabinet, but legal advice was sought there and then because the chief legal officer was in the room, and you know. It was absolutely sound. And, of course, Jeff Gollop was the chap in charge when... I've got a lot of time for him. He's a nice bloke. But he was the chap in charge of finance when George Ferguson was...
Well, he is a chartered accountant.
Yes, he is.
He has no reason to lie because, frankly, he is old enough to not require his seat anymore, I guess. Sorry, Jeff, but, you know, we're both men of an age. There is also a little bit of talk, talking about social care and adult education, special needs adult education. There was a big splash, £1.3 million ring-fenced for that, and then that was kind of retracted slightly after the announcement, and that's £500,000 expanding out to 2023 now. There's a lot of sound bites and a lot of big promises coming out of Marvin's office. I'm not, you know, you are a Labour councillor, but this is coming out of Marvin's office. Grabbing headlines, you know, strong and stable, oven ready, all of this stuff. And he's kind of rolling back from it quite quickly.
I don't think he is. I mean, you know, obviously it's an election and obviously we've got sort of, you know, he's going to, you know, we're going to put our manifesto out. We get all the other parties will as well. Two of the parties want to scrap the mail system. I think, you know, when you think about the last 4 years, we've had, you know, Marvin's got us involved in the Global Parliament of Mayors, so he's actually got us working with other cities and other city leadership across the globe, and has actually helped put Bristol far more on the map than was previously the case.
Okay.
And I think, you know, how ambitious are we as a city? Do we actually want to be global players? You know, if things are going to get more devolved, if people are going to have to collaborate and share ideas at a more local level, do we want to be involved in that, or do we just want to sit back and go back to being what we were before?
Or is the litmus test of a successful city how it treats its most in need? That's something for you to ponder while we hear from Sarah Vaughan.
Every time from heaven, don't you know?
heaven. You'll find your fortune falling all over town. Be sure that your umbrella is upside down. Trade them for a package of sunshine and flowers. If you want the things you love, you must have showers. So when you hear it thunder, don't run under a tree. There'll be pennies from heaven for you and me. Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven? Find your fortune falling all over town. Be sure that your umbrella is upside down. Trade them for a package of sunshine and flowers.
Lovely work. Sarah Vaughan, slightly under-celebrated in the pantheon of great voices, I think. Welcome back. It's this politics show here on BCFM 93.2. I'm Billy Quain, deputising for Tony Gosling, who's gone in as Holly Hawes. Luckily for us, Martin Summers is still here. Hello, Martin.
Hello.
Excellent. And Fabian Breckles from...
Troopers Hill, St George Troopers Hill.
Yes, you're very good at this. A sitting Labour councillor for St George's Troopers Hill is in the studio with a turnout of 44.48% in the 2016 ward elections. Do you know how many unique votes you achieved?
What do you mean by that?
Well, what was your majority?
Something up to 300 or something like that. I mean, I think the Tories were hoping to take the seat and they didn't succeed.
Well done you. You've fought the law, and the law didn't win. Now, also in the studio, I'm delighted to welcome, for the first time ever making a BCFM appearance, although he is quite well known to viewers of Channel 5's GPs Behind Closed Doors, Dr. David Jewell from the Horfield Surgery. David, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Billy.
Excellent. Thank you so much for coming down. We were talking the local budget and social care, but frankly, you just can't escape coronavirus this week. Or can you? Medical question to start off.
Well, nobody knows quite how to avoid it, Billy. That's the problem. That's one of the many problems. The lack of knowledge. Nobody knows quite how this thing behaves. Is a real problem. Before I came in here just now, I was reading an article from somebody in Hong Kong who talks about the problems of the virus, but he also says the problem is the amount of panic that's been induced by all the information going around the world. Mm.
Should we be worried?
Well, I mean, as individuals, here's the problem. This is a very common thing in medicine. As individuals, I don't think we should be unduly worried. Individually, we might catch it, but I don't think, in general terms, for an individual, it's going to be much more than nasty flu. The problem is the numbers. None of us have any immunity to it. And the thing I've read is that it might, if it breaks out here in a big scale, it might affect anything up to 60% of individuals. Now, the numbers there are huge.
Gargantuan.
And that's the problem. It's not that the disease itself is so awful. It's that none of us have got any immunity to it. And therefore, if we have an epidemic, it'll be on a huge scale.
When you say huge scale, are we talking about, you know, Spanish influenza, which incidentally we're celebrating the centenary of this year?
Probably not. I think none of us really know quite why that was so unbelievably devastating. But it's quite likely that it was the end result of 4 years when people hadn't eaten properly and there'd been awful problems of nutrition and everything. So I don't think that it's on that scale.
Fabian, what have you been hearing in the corridors of power about Bristol's preparation for a potential outbreak?
Well, it's early days yet. I mean, I was just thinking there's some questions that are coming from what you're saying. You know, like, you know, if Spanish flu was so horrific because people hadn't eaten very well, does that mean it's going to hit the poorest and the undernourished, you know, the working poor, harder?
Or the obese? Who knows?
Well, I mean, you know, and also how do the figure, you know, I mean, we still really don't know what this thing is, do we?
No. I mean, on the whole, again, with the information we have, it does seem to affect more those older people with comorbidities. And we've got lots of those. But we read about this young, I think, ophthalmologist doctor who was the first to draw attention to it, who died of it, and he was a young, healthy doctor. I mean, again, we don't really know. The answer to your question is, will it affect the poor more? The answer is, you expect so, because everything does.
Mm. Interesting. Let's talk about social care. And David, I'd like you to participate slightly in this conversation because you are sufficiently experienced in your profession to remember a time when doctors still made house visits. There was a closer relationship between local healthcare professionals and local authorities. And there is the budget is proposing a 2% ring-fenced increase in council tax. This is the local budget, the local Bristol City Council budget, specifically for adult social care and child social care. So it is a care, if not a healthcare issue. So there's, I think, an interesting crack in the pavement for you both to tease out in this discussion ahead of the budget.
Before you go any further, Billy, I do have to correct you. There are general practitioners in the country who still do house visits. I did one only last week.
Did it feel retro?
No, absolutely not. How dare you?
It's an interesting point.
Well, it is a very interesting point. I mean, if I take students on house visits, one of the questions I ask is, well, why is that different? And it just is a very different feel. I've always enjoyed doing them, and long may it continue.
And with this principle of self-isolation, the 14-day self-isolation, it may become a thing that is increased significantly. Fabian, what are the thoughts from inside? What exactly is this 2% increase going towards?
It's going towards adult social care. I mean, it's the problem with all of this is we can only raise so much council tax without having to have, you know, there are government caps.
Yeah, there are guidelines.
Raise. So, you know, we do have a growing population, you know, an aging population, and the social care is only going to increase because there'll be more and more frail elderly people are living long. Well, life expectancy is starting to wane and fall back now, which is the consequence of austerity. But, you know, we have got to provide adequate care. And, you know, I know in the last general election and the one before, we were talking about having an adult's of amalgamating adult social care into the National Health Service, so you had a National Health and Care Service. And I think that could have made a lot of sense, because often you can have situations where frail elderly people are bed blocking in a hospital bed because there's nowhere for them to go in the care system. So that's holding things up in the hospital. But they can't be discharged because there's nowhere to discharge them to. So if you actually combine the whole lot, it'll be much easier to coordinate. This person needs social care going forward. getting it arranged, if it's all adequately funded, getting it arranged and getting people into adequate.
So,
I mean, this happened last time the Tories were in power back in the 90s.
It happens
you
all
had
the time.
Bed blocking. You had bed blocking then, and now it's happening again, isn't it?
But is this, are you kind of intimating there is a halcyon, not a halcyon, a sort of Elysian sanitarium system where people are, you know, people who still need soft touch care are no longer in hospitals. They're moved on to a kind of halfway house.
We need to sort out, you know, we need to have the conversation, probably needs to be a cross party conversation, you know, and involve healthcare professionals about how we fix this problem and try and find a long term solution, not just one for the next, until the next election, but something going forward that will, you know, and then that includes how do we pay for it with taxes or whatever. How, you know, what are we going to do and how are we going to pay for it? We need to have that conversation because at the moment it's just sort of, you know, filling up cracks in the wall that's cracking, getting, you know, the cracks are getting bigger and we're just shoving more and more filler in it and the crack's not fixed, you know. We need more fundamental restructuring of the whole system.
Without jeopardising your Hippocratic Oath, David, what are you seeing in the office?
Never took it, Billy.
Well done, you. you immoral doctor, you. what are you seeing? What are you surprised and disappointed by, patient-wise, presenting with preventables?
If you sit where I occasionally still sit, in a consulting room, and just see the people who come in front of you, and then go to the nursing home and see the people there, you don't see it. The people I think who are struggling, as Fabian points out, are the people who are trying to keep the hospital functioning well. And actually, if I think about that, one of the things that we do notice is when the hospital is struggling, which happens every so often. We get a notice from the hospital saying, we're full, please don't send any patients in. And one of my former colleagues thought she wanted to send an answer back saying, actually, we're full. Please don't discharge any patients back to us. Because it doesn't really help. It's a desperate thing to do.
Yeah.
And that's what we notice. And then you say, well, why has that happened? Well, one of the things that's happened in our lifetime, Billy. Yes, you're not as old as me. Of course, I know that. But one of the things that's happened in our lifetime is that they've reduced the numbers of hospital beds. Now, this might be justifiable if they provided more of the schemes that operate in the community. But as you probably know, primary care in this country has not had the investment it should have had over the last 10, 20 years or so.
No.
Well,
you're
getting 50,000 nurses.
Oh, come on.
No one believes that.
Listen, there is a fantastic scheme in Bristol. We should give credit where it's due. There's a fantastic scheme in Bristol. It's called Rapid Response. Actually, I'm not sure what it is, but people are always changing names. Very Chinese habit. But there is a team of nurses who do fantastic work looking after people who would otherwise have to go into hospital. Yeah. And they are really excellent.
And, yeah, and so often people are out there doing good stuff and it doesn't hit the news because it's not a negative story. It's not knocking anybody. And, you know, we just don't know this stuff's going on.
No, I completely agree with that. I was talking to a friend yesterday about the effect that the tabloids have on things. And I was reminded of the quote, and I don't even know if it's true, but it sounds so close to the truth.
Oh, it does.
It was a quote that Lord Rothermere, who was the founder of the Daily Mail, was asked late in life how he'd managed to make the Daily Mail so successful. And he said, oh, it's very simple. I give the British public something to hate every day.
Yes. Yeah, and it is so negative. You think about, you know, you think about some of the headlines about, you know, immigrants and stuff like that, and then you end up, you know, with increasing xenophobia post-Brexit and all of that. And it's all being stoked by magazines like the, you know, papers like The Mail, or you've got The Express, you know, saying, you know, extreme weather and, you know, deluges of snow, and it's, you know, and it never really happens. You know, when it does really happen, they don't really.
Well, it's happened every weekend for the last three, and we've got quite a lot
deluges of... Deluges of rain, yeah, not snow.
It's not something we're going to fix in a radio studio this evening.
Nope.
We are running up to the 7 o'clock news. There are a couple of more things. Fabian, are you available to stay with us after the news?
Yeah, happy to.
Good, excellent, because we haven't gotten our teeth into the election of your new party leader just yet.
Okay.
Maybe divisive. I would also like to look, Martin, with some of your help in the second hour of the broadcast, at 100 years since the Treaty of Versailles and how, incidentally, this week, yet again, some of Britain's withdrawing from colony policies are coming back and blood is still being let worldwide.
Okay.
There's riots in Mumbai.
International affairs.
Yeah, we'll have a little look at the international affairs. We may discuss the Arab Spring. I don't think we will because William Hague doesn't like it. Well, that's part of it. It will play into that because the Border Commission, which was set up in 1920, incidentally, it's celebrating its own centenary this year. I'm afraid the hens have come home to roost with Sinn Féin winning more seats than any other political party in the Irish general election 2 weeks ago. I foresee, as an Irishman, as a card-carrying Irishman with the accent and everything, that we will have 18 months in a Belgian style of no effective government and nothing untoward will happen. The civil service will make sure that things continue more or less as they always do. Decisions will be made. There will be Grey Sir Humphreys making them, and everybody will be quite happy and, I don't know, dare I say it, show some of the egoistic politicians up for the empty windbags that maybe they sometimes are.
It'd be interesting to see, because have been reports that there could be early elections again soon if they can't settle something soon. I mean, we shall see how it pans out.
But the experience in Israel of repeated elections to try and sort out something that is not a good example.
Well, we could start on Israel, but that really is a can of worms that possibly we're best leaving until we've all had an extra biscuit. Do get in touch with us this evening. Fabian is staying with us, Martin is staying, and David, you're also staying. We're going to be talking about some of the dwellers on Bristol streets after the news at 7 o'clock as well. And of course, if you'd like to get in touch, if you'd like to nudge me in a direction, or indeed if you'd like to request some climate themed music, then drop me a line, studio@bcfmradio.com, or indeed you can send me a text message. 60777 is the number, started with BCFM. It will come straight through to me here in the studio. But now it's time for the news.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.